I want you to imagine just for a moment walking into this dark, really damp cave system with one specific goal. You are there to meet up with a childhood friend.
Right, someone you spent hours playing pretend with.
Exactly. Someone who knows the intricate architecture of your earliest memories. But when you finally arrive at the rendezvous point, the person waiting for you isn't, the awkward, familiar kid from your neighborhood.
Not at all.
Instead, they have fundamentally transformed. They are standing before you as an ancient, glowing, incredibly powerful sorceress, and they're calmly informing you that the fantastical games you used to play in the backyard, well, they were actually real the entire time.
I mean, it is the ultimate psychological whiplash. You are forced to stand there and try to reconcile your very grounded, mundane memories of this person with a staggering, undeniable, magical reality standing right in front of you.
Yeah, it's a lot to process.
It completely destabilizes your understanding of what is real and what is imagined.
And that precise destabilization is the engine driving our deep dive today. We are examining a truly fascinating set of sources, specifically this rich, highly detailed log titled Mirari.
It's such an incredible text.
It really is. It chronicles the journey of three youths, Thomas, Alice, and Agatha. We're following them as they navigate an incredibly dangerous, razor-thin intersection between our normal, everyday reality and the deeply complex, magical realm of Mirari.
And the log is just a masterclass in blurring boundaries. It presents us with characters carrying ordinary backpacks and flashlights, but forces them to interact with ancient fey politics, environmental magic systems, and shape-shifting knights.
Our mission today is to sift through this collision of worlds. We want to extract the core themes of identity, the mechanics of trust, and the immense burden of destiny. Because beneath the surface layer of magic spells and mythical creatures, this source material is dealing with some profound truths about the mechanics of growing up and the weight of the past. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the sheer psychological tension of that initial cavern rendezvous.
The author constructs the atmosphere of this opening scene with absolute precision to establish the stakes.
The setting does a lot of the heavy lifting here, right? The group is approaching the secret caves under One Eyes Hill.
Yeah, and the text gives us this visceral, claustrophobic picture.
It is pitch black. Thomas, who goes by the title Lord Explorer, is leading the way. He's sweeping a flashlight beam over hanging stalactites and these slick, water-eroded floors.
Just incredibly tense.
Eventually, they reach a subterranean intersection where three distinct streams converge into a triangular pool. And out of that water, rising completely dry, is Nimue.
This is the childhood friend Rebecca, completely reborn. She is now the lady sorceress of the lake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the text describes her radiating a distinct fey glow. She's dressed in an elegant white gown trimmed in green, wearing a silver circlet with a green gemstone resting above her nose.
And she's just walking on the water.
Exactly. She is a woman fully grown, defying the laws of physics by walking perfectly dry across the surface of the pool.
The reactions from the group highlight a really fascinating divide in how we process the impossible. Alice, who is physically burdened with two heavy spell books, operates purely on emotional recognition.
She just sees her friend.
Right. Her immediate instinct is to run out onto the water and embrace her. Thomas, however, reacts with intense tactical suspicion. He practically throws his arm out to physically block Alice from moving forward.
He's not taking any chances.
Not at all. He demands Mimue prove her identity, treating her less like a long-lost friend and more like a hostile, shape-shifting threat.
Well, Thomas is operating from a place of deep, recent trauma combined with strategic caution. His experiences have taught him that in the ecosystem of Mirari, a familiar, comforting face is frequently deployed as the most lethal kind of weapon. Deception is a primary tool of war in this realm.
That makes sense fundamentally, but I have to push back on Thomas's logic in this specific moment. He is essentially demanding a magical two-factor authentication for what he perceives as a real-life phishing scam.
That's a great way to put it.
He wants her to answer security questions to prove she isn't a malicious entity. But considering Thomas literally just returned from traveling through a foreign magical land alongside elves, his paranoia feels slightly misplaced.
A bit hypocritical, yeah.
Exactly. He is intensely judging her for undergoing a magical transformation while completely ignoring how deeply entangled he himself has become in those same magical systems.
What's fascinating here is how Nimue systematically dismantles that exact hypocrisy. She doesn't take the bait.
She doesn't do a magic trick for him.
Right. She doesn't perform some grand, overwhelming feat of magic to satisfy Thomas's demand for proof. Instead, She bypasses him entirely and turns her attention to Alice.
Which is such a power move.
It really is. Nimue authenticates her identity by accessing what we might call the biometric data of the soul-shared lived experiences that magic cannot artificially generate. She reminds Alice of how they used to negotiate power dynamics in their childhood games. Specifically, how she used to let Alice be the boss.
Oh, I love that.
And more importantly, she recalls how Alice's human mother taught them both how to properly apply bandages.
That specific detail about the bandages is brilliant because it is utterly mundane. A magical spy or a shapeshifter might know the broad strokes of their history, but they would never bother to assimilate the memory of sitting on a bathroom floor learning basic first aid.
Precisely. Nimue explicitly states that she has broken the seal on her past identity as Rebecca. This introduces a vital concept about how this universe handles the self.
How so?
Well, identity in Mirari is incredibly fluid. You can simultaneously be a suburban teenager and an ancient fae sorceress. But that fluidity is anchored by immutable, unglamorous core memories. The magical transformation did not overwrite the neurological pathways formed during those childhood interactions.
It is a really sophisticated way of looking at human development. We all break the seal on the children we used to be, but those foundational experiences remain intact beneath whatever adult identity we assume. And once that fundamental trust is established, once Thomas realizes he is dealing with the true essence of his friend, the focus of the group immediately shifts from authenticating a person to authenticating highly dangerous objects.
The handover of the spellbook provides a critical window into how these characters are adapting to their reality.
The tactical brilliance hidden inside Alice's initial innocence is such a great reveal. Alice, who seconds ago was ready to blindly hug a glowing fey entity, reveals she was actually carrying two books the entire time.
A total bait and switch.
Yes. One of them is a complete decoy. It is her personal notebook filled with doodles and silly songs, carried specifically to be sacrificed just in case Nimue turned out to be a trap. She only relinquishes the actual powerful spellbook once the psychological two-factor authentication clears.
It demonstrates that Alice understands the lethal rules of engagement governing their situation. She may desire the comfort of her past, but she is actively protecting a magical artifact with military precision.
The way the narrative constantly forces modern technology to collide with ancient magic is incredibly striking here, too. Agatha, the designated knight of the group, decides this tense reunion requires a group photo.
Of course she does.
She pulls out an entirely ordinary, mundane camera. And the physics of the dark cave obviously won't allow for a good exposure. So Nimue simply raises a hand and utilizes an ancient incantation. By the Eastern powers, sun, cast thy light on us to generate a literal magical flashbulb.
And as the spell detonates, Agatha and Alice cheerfully yell, Googa Mooga!
It's so funny.
The juxtaposition is brilliant. You have the utilization of elemental ancient power to facilitate something as trivial as a teenage photo op. But this lighthearted moment is a deliberate misdirection.
Right, because things get serious fast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
While the camera flashes to capture their present reality, the artifacts Alice subsequently pulls out of her purse completely unravel their understanding of the past.
The text delivers a massive lore drop right here. Alice unpacks two specific treasures she has been carrying, an intricate mirror and the medallion.
Nimue's reaction to these items completely changes the atmosphere. She identifies the mirror as belonging to Lady Angelique of House April, who is an incredibly significant figure in the ancient political history of Mirari.
Okay.
But the medallion is the catalyst for a total paradigm shift.
Alice casually explains that the medallion belongs to her physical stuffed animal, Sir Teddy Bear. And Nimue connects the dots, realizing that this specific medallion belonged to Sir Theodore.
We really have to understand the gravity of Sir Theodore in the Mirari mythos. He wasn't just a knight. He was a shape-shifting bear who served as the ultimate protector of Lady Angelique.
Wait, a literal bear?
A literal shape-shifting bear.
Huh?
And he sacrificed his life defending her. He was brutally beheaded by a cataclysmic dark force known as the Year's End.
Wow.
Yeah, the Year's End functions in the lore as an apocalyptic epic or entity that sought to consume their world. Theodore was eventually resurrected, cementing his status as a legendary figure of sacrifice.
The mechanical implications of this are just staggering. Alice's literal stuffed animal, this plush toy she likely slept next to, is deeply, inextricably tied to this violent, tragic Mirari history.
It's intense.
The lore implies that these mundane objects act as dormant magical vessels. They aren't just representations of history, they are physical anchors for it.
It forces the characters and the listener to completely recontextualize their formative years. The comfort objects they thought were mere playthings are revealed to be latent artifacts of a devastating war.
That realization creates a natural bridge to the next phase of their journey. Because if their past was built on hidden magical truths, their future is going to be dictated by them. We follow the group as they leave the damp cave and relocate to the upstairs bedroom of the old Harcourt Manor.
And in this domestic space, Nimue drops a geopolitical bombshell on Alice.
She really does.
Nimue fundamentally alters Alice's understanding of her own existence. She details the history of a royal baby in Merari, Princess Angel of Umbreck. The official state narrative was that the princess died at birth, a fabrication created by the king to protect her from political assassins.
Why? Right.
Nimue then reveals that Alice is, in all likelihood, that mythical princess, hidden away in the mundane world for her own survival.
It is the ultimate fantasy trope, right? The hidden heir. But the text immediately grounds it with a brutal restriction. Nimue explains that Alice possesses the latent talent to become a staggeringly powerful sorceress, or she can return to Merari and claim her political birthright as the ruling princess.
But you cannot do both.
Exactly. She is absolutely forbidden from doing both.
Yeah.
Ancient Merari law strictly mandates that a sorceress can never sit on the throne as queen.
This specific legal parameter is just a fascinating piece of world building.
I found myself dwelling on the mechanics of that law. Why would a society force a hard separation between magical capability and a political rulership? Is this an ancient version of separating church and state, designed purely as a system of checks and balances?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is an incredibly astute observation on the nature of totalitarianism.
How do you mean?
In a world where magic is an actual physical force, combining ultimate mystical power with ultimate political authority creates a scenario where tyranny is mathematically inevitable. The law exists because Merari history likely already proved that a ruler who can both command armies and bend reality to their will cannot be held accountable by the governed. The division of power is a survival mechanism for the realm.
The political philosophy is deep, but Alice's reaction to this monumental crossroads is remarkably grounded. You'd anticipate a character agonizing over whether to become an all-powerful magic user or a sovereign monarch.
But she doesn't do that at all.
No. Instead, Alice bypasses the grandeur entirely. She reflects on the values instilled by her adoptive human mother. Alice plainly states she doesn't think she possesses the aptitude for advanced sorcery, nor the temperament to rule a kingdom.
She just wants to help people.
Right. She expresses a simple desire to be a healer, noting that her mom always told her she would make an excellent nurse or doctor.
This decision speaks volumes about the debate between nature and nurture within the text. Despite possessing the genetic bloodline of royalty and the latent capacity for magic, Alice's core identity is defined by the empathy cultivated by her mundane upbringing. She deliberately chooses a path of service over a path of absolute power.
It serves as a powerful reminder that destiny might present you with a path, but your deeply held values dictate whether you actually walk down it. While Alice is indoors quietly rejecting absolute power, the text deliberately fractures the narrative.
We move outside.
Yeah, we find Agatha actively engaging with the military realities of their situation, consulting with some highly unusual allies.
The author shifts us from internal philosophical contemplation directly into external tactical planning. Agatha is out in the stables convening what is essentially an animal council.
Agatha is conferring with Destra, who outwardly appears to be a black stallion, but is fundamentally a highly intelligent night steed, and Kuon, who looks like a greyhound, but possesses complete cognitive understanding of human speech.
The mechanics of their communication are incredibly layered.
They really are. Destra doesn't just understand Agatha. He actively responds. He uses physical pantomime to explicitly warn Agatha against trusting another night steed named Sohype.
This emphasizes how intelligence and agency in Merari are not exclusive to humanoids. The animals are active political and tactical participants, and their input is vital because the group is facing a massive logistical failure. They cannot figure out how to transport themselves back into the magical realm.
Nimue attempts to open a portal by summoning something called the Siege of Wind. The visual is striking. She is physically spinning in the garden, calling out to the cardinal directions to rip open a gateway.
But it doesn't work.
The magic simply collapses. She stops and admits she cannot force the portal open because the environmental winds are in flux.
The mechanical failure of the portal is crucial to understanding the power dynamics at play here. It demonstrates that the mundane world actively resists and stifles magical physics. Even the Lady Sorceress of the Lake is severely limited by the atmospheric and environmental conditions of our reality.
They are operating at a massive disadvantage.
A huge one.
Which necessitates a drastically different approach. Unable to physically travel, Nimue determines they need immediate reconnaissance regarding their missing ally, the Lord Protector.
And this is where things get wild.
To gather this intelligence, she initiates the ritual of Lord Melchizedek. And the execution of this tracking spell is where the mundane and the mythical collide most violently.
Because the focal point she requires to anchor this complex magical working is completely unexpected.
She uses Alice's freshly laundered stuffed unicorn, Lord Mauen. The ritual requires precise physical setup. Nimue places her spellbook on the grass and centers a large, flat stone on the lawn. The text is incredibly rich with sensory data here. You can almost smell the earth as she tears up handfuls of grass to form a ring around the stone.
And Agatha is helping set up.
Right. Agatha positions four white candles at the compass points. Nimue begins a rhythmic incantation, Avriar Leoniel, calling upon the north, south, east, and west to locate the Lord Protector. A sudden, violent wind whips through the garden, immediately extinguishing three of the candles. And here's where it gets really interesting.
The manifestation over that final flame is breathtaking.
A unicorn appears directly above the flickering candle, but it has shed its plush, mundane form completely.
Oh, totally.
It is an imposing apparition of a black unicorn, its body appearing as if carved from solid obsidian. Most strikingly, its mane and tail are composed of literal red and orange fire, crackling audibly in the night air.
The mechanics of the ritual reveal that the stuffed animal wasn't just a toy. It was a sympathetic link, a necessary physical bridge required to pull the true essence of the creature across the dimensional divide.
But there's a catch, right?
Yes. Despite the chaotic energy of the summoning, the actual exchange of intelligence happens in complete silence.
The unicorn bows its head to the girls and physically opens its mouth to speak, but the atmospheric resistance of the mundane world literally tears the words away before they can be heard.
So they have to improvise.
Agatha has to rely on visual confirmation. She deduces the unicorn is looking intently to the west. She asks if he is trapped there by a specific villain Thomas had been tracking, an entity known as the Jack of Hearts.
And the response is chilling.
The flaming unicorn gives a sharp, definitive nod, rears up on its hind legs, and vanishes entirely.
This raises an important question regarding the survival of these characters. The Jack of Hearts, within the context of the lore, represents an archetype of chaos and deceit. This is an entity powerful enough to completely neutralize and imprison the Lord Protector, who is supposed to be one of the most formidable forces in Mirari.
So they're in real trouble.
The silent nod confirms their worst-case scenario. How can a group of youths whose magic is so severely stifled by the mundane world that they can barely keep a candle lit or open a portal, possibly mount a rescue mission against an adversary of that magnitude?
The disparity in power is terrifying. They are preparing to step into a mythological war zone armed with flashlights, a camera, and a few dormant artifacts. And that staggering contrast really synthesizes the entire mission of this deep dive. The narrative constantly forces you, the listener, to process the mundane and the mythical simultaneously.
It is the defining architectural feature of the text.
Consider the whiplash of these events. Over the course of a single hour, these characters go from trying to figure out the logistics of hiding a magical horse in a suburban stable to Agatha casually offering to run inside and grab a few bottles of Coke for the ancient fae sorceress who just finished summoning a flaming obsidian unicorn on the front lawn.
The physical presence of the Coke bottles existing in the exact same space as fae fire perfectly encapsulates the dual existence they are navigating. It highlights how quickly human beings can normalize the extraordinary when forced to adapt.
Definitely. And I want you to consider how the underlying mechanics of this story map onto your own life. We all possess personal artifacts from our past. It might be a specific stuffed animal, a worn photograph, or a notebook filled with old handwriting.
We all have them.
Right. And just like Alice, as we navigate the process of growing up, we are continually forced to decide which version of our identity we're going to step into. We have to make conscious choices about which childhood games we leave behind in the dark and which core values will shape the adults we become.
The concept of breaking the seal on who we used to be is a universal psychological process. We must integrate our past experiences into our present reality without letting them completely dictate our future.
So what does this all mean? When we peel back the layers of fae portals and flaming unicorns, what is the fundamental truth embedded in this log for Mirari?
Well, it leaves us with a deeply provocative paradox to evaluate. The characters in this narrative began their lives treating Murari as nothing more than a childhood game of make-believe, a psychological tool to escape the mundane world. But the narrative completely inverts that dynamic, revealing that the games they played were actually the hidden structural architecture of reality all along. It begs a serious question. What deeply held childhood beliefs, what specific imaginative frameworks or games in your own life might actually carry profound real-world weight that you simply haven't recognized yet?